You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 23rd, 2024. I'm Elliot Nelson from Drake University. Here is your first story. It's entitled Adjournment Sign Die. The subcategory of it is Lawmakers Wrap Up Their Work Saturday Morning. It's written by Aaron Murphy and Caleb McCulloch of the Gazette from the Des Moines Bureau. There's a picture of the Iowa House, specifically with seats, and there's people, representatives, sitting in the seats. The subcaption to this is, Iowa House lawmakers are seated shortly after 4 a.m. on Saturday, April 20th, 2024, taking a vote on the last bill of the 2024 legislative session. After two marathon sessions, totaling 38 hours across a little more than 2 days, state lawmakers and the Iowa legislature concluded their work for 2024 in the early morning hours Saturday at the Iowa Capitol. The Iowa House was the second and last chamber to finish its work. The body adjourned, signed die, at 3 a.m. Saturday, the 104th legislative day of the session. The 2024 session was marked by one piece of legislation in particular, Governor Kim Reynolds' proposal to overhaul how special education support is delivered in the state by its 9 area education agencies, and how those agencies are funded. The AEA bill dominated the first 3 months of the legislative session, making progress on anything else nearly impossible. After hours of public testimony from parents of students with disabilities who worried their children would lose critical care, along with testimony from some school superintendents who backed the proposal, Reynolds signed the final bill into law in March. Once the bill is fully phased in, the area education agencies will receive 90% of school funding for special education support, while 10% will remain with the district. State lawmakers worked late into the night Thursday and Friday, and into the early morning hours of Saturday, as they crafted an $8.5 billion state budget, passed the last batch of policy bills, and let a final few bills die, including a proposed 5-year extension of a moratorium on new casinos in the state. The House approved the next casino moratorium just before 1 a.m. Saturday, but in the session's final 3 hours, the Senate declined to take up the bill. This means that the current 2-year moratorium will expire when it ends in June. After that point, interested parties will be able to start the application process through the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission. Republican reactions are next sub-caption of this. Iowa Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitford, Republican from Grimes, claimed victories for State House Republicans on another round of state income tax cuts, immigration, and inflation. Big and bold ideas have always been our focus, and our caucus has never shied away from difficult or complex issues. This year was no different, Whitford said in a statement. This session was another tremendous success for Senate Republicans, as we kept our promises to Iowans and focused on big reforms, bold changes, and major tax relief. I know we all look forward to a break from this session and to return in 2025, ready to continue making Iowa the best place to live in the world. House Speaker Pat Grassley, a Republican from New Hartford, said House Republicans laid out an agenda at the start of the session and followed through on passing those bills. We've been trying to do that since I've been in leadership, trying to really lay out a bold agenda that we campaign on. Try to follow through on them, Grassley said. The things that we're taking from all across the state and all 99 counties, we're trying to reflect those in legislation that we're putting together. The Democratic reaction. Iowa House Democratic Leader Jennifer Confirst of Windsor Heights said the session had been defined by Republicans making life harder for Iowans in areas of voting, economic opportunity, and special education. Confirst criticized State House Republicans for moving the AEA overhaul bill despite initial unease from many in the party about Reynolds' first proposal. She said the bill mobilized thousands of people who were opposed to the change. It was never about the AEAs. It's always been about politics. It's always been about special interest, she said, and kids will suffer. Confirst said House Democrats, meanwhile, had been proposing policies that had broad support among Iowans and they believe will improve living conditions in the state. House Democrats introduced bills this year to increase the state's minimum wage, create a constitutionally protected right to collective bargaining, and extend that state's sales tax holiday. With a minority in both chambers, Democrats have little ability to influence policy. We introduced all of those things, and Republicans ignored each and every one of them, Confirst said. Things we've introduced as legislative sessions, were for everyday Americans to help make their lives better, and the Republicans chose politics and special interests. Senate Democrats pursued many of those same policies. They introduced a constitutional amendment that would have protected abortion rights in the Iowa Constitution and introduced policies to increase funding and staffing at nursing homes. Senate Minority Leader Pam Jochim, a Democrat from Dubuque, said on Friday that Democrats have worked to improve freedom, opportunity, and accountability throughout the session. Jochim, who is not running for re-election, suggested the Republicans' policy agency agenda will be a liability in the November election. Iowans will remember how Republicans chose to serve their governor rather than their constituents, Jochim said. They'll remember how they slashed our area education agencies and put special interests over Iowa's children, and they will remember in November. Governor's reaction. Reynolds' office highlighted the myriad bills she proposed or supported that were approved by the Republican majority Iowa legislature, some of which were altered significantly before coming to her desk, including the AA bill. Iowa has set a course for transformation, and it was the driving force for legislative session, Reynolds said in the statement. Iowa is a state that values education, rewards hard work, and encourages strong families, a place where government is driven by a sense of responsibility to the people it serves. I'm proud of what we've accomplished this year, and I look forward to continuing to build upon our strong foundation, ensuring prosperity and stability for every Iowan. Our next part is a part of the digest, entitled Council Bluffs Residents Sentenced in Drug Case. A Council Bluffs man was sentenced on April 11th to 15 years in federal prison after pleading guilty in a drug trafficking case. Diana Morales, 30, was a drug supplier to co-defendant Donovan Edward Belts, 25, who distributed methamphetamine in the Council Bluffs metropolitan area, according to a news release from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Iowa. Belts pleaded guilty to one count of a three-count indictment, the release states, citing public court documents. Morales was sentenced on December 11th to 10 years in prison after pleading guilty to two counts of a three-count indictment, the release states. In February 2023, law enforcement completed a controlled buy at the residence of Morales and Belt, resulting in the seizure of nearly 113 grams of methamphetamine, according to the release. A subsequent search found additional meth. After prison, Belt must serve a five-year term of supervised release, while Morales must serve 3 years. There is no parole in the federal system. The Southwest Iowa Narcotics Enforcement Task Force and the Council Bluffs Police Department investigated the case. Our next story is entitled Kansas City Men Sentenced for Drugs After High-Speed Chase. A Kansas man was sentenced on April 11th to more than 21 years in federal prison after a jury trial in Council Bluffs on drug charges. George Madison Kitchen IV, a 46-year-old resident of Kansas City, Kansas, was found guilty on two counts of an indictment and sentenced to 260 months in prison, according to a news release from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Iowa. Co-defendant Cardell Jordan Harris, 26, was sentenced on December 12th to 10 years in prison. Kitchen and Harris were transporting methamphetamine from Kansas City, Missouri, with the destination of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, according to the release, citing public court documents. In July 2022, law enforcement stopped Kitchen for a traffic violation with Harris as a passenger. Kitchen and Harris were asked to step outside of the vehicle due to the odor of marijuana. Instead, they fled the scene. Kitchen led law enforcement on a high-speed pursuit northbound on Interstate 29. They were stopped north of Council Bluffs. Kitchen and Harris threw bags out the passenger side window while speeding along the interstate, according to the release. Officers found the bags along the interstate, which resulted in discovery of distribution quantities of methamphetamine and cocaine. After prison, Kitchen must serve a 10-year term of supervised release, and Harris must serve a 5-year term. There is no parole in the federal system. The Council Bluffs Police Department, Harrison County Sheriff's Office, and the Missouri Valley Police Department were involved in the apprehension. The Pottawamie County Sheriff's Office and the Southwest Iowa Narcotics Enforcement Task Force were involved in the apprehension investigation of the case. Our next story is entitled, Colorado Man Gets 18 Months for Transporting Marijuana on I-80. A man arrested for transporting 34 kilograms of marijuana last year was sentenced to 18 months in federal prison for possession with intent to distribute a controlled substance. Hongdin Nguyen, a 42-year-old resident of Commerce City, Colorado, was arrested in Council Bluffs on April 22, 2023, following a traffic stop on Interstate 80, according to a news release from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Iowa. The news release, which was based on information from public court documents and evidence presented at sentencing, stated that officers conducting the stop found Nguyen's vehicle had a strong odor of marijuana coming from the inside. An investigation by the Division of Narcotics Enforcement of the Iowa Department of Public Safety and the Iowa State Patrol found 34,424 grams of marijuana in heat-sealed bags in the trunk of Nguyen's vehicle. Nguyen agreed to transport and deliver the marijuana to another person in Minnesota and told authorities he would have paid $6,300. He would have been paid $6,300 for making the delivery, according to the release. After prison, Nguyen will be required to serve 3 years of supervised release. There is no parole in the federal system. Our next story is entitled Nonprofits Calm Kits Promote Mental Health, written by Rachel George of the Council City, Council Bluffs Nonpareil. It has a photo with it, which has a package that says sail on and fly high, as well as other things that go inside this package to be sent out. A calm kit assembled by local organization Sail On and Fly High offers items that can help a person use their senses to ground themselves back into the present during a heightened state of emotion. Here's the story. A local nonprofit is working to spread kindness and awareness of the importance of mental health while finding ways to support community members who may be experiencing big emotions. Sail On and Fly High was founded by Dave and Cassie Lawrence in honor of their 16-year-old son, Sailor, who died by suicide on March 16, 2021. The organization pledges to be the sails that help our community navigate the rough seas of mental health, raise suicide awareness, stop the stigma, and be the wings of hope for all. The organization has been sharing calm kits, tools that can be used to lower anxieties, reduce rage, and ground someone back into the present. "We really want to do a project that would benefit a large portion of the community," Cassie Lawrence said. They knew there would be no one thing that could cover all ages, but they say the calm kits are good for ages 10 to 110. The idea came to be just over a year ago, as Sail On and Fly High had connected with a therapist who requested some supplies for a support group they were sponsoring. He had asked for scented lotion and flavored chapstick. While Dave and I had been reading information in science journals, trying to gather information that was helpful to others with the way our nonprofit was going, Lawrence said. The idea really bloomed after talking with a therapist, coordinating with doctors, and learning about different mechanisms that help people work through big emotional feelings. We just had such great feedback from the kits we handed out, and we weren't aware of anyone else doing this kind of initiative in our community. We really wanted to give back to the community, to not only bring awareness, but to help people in these moments in a vast age range. The first 100 kits were distributed last year at the second ever Council Bluffs Mental Health Awareness event. The kits include things like scented lotion or hand sanitizer, flavored lip balm, mint gum, earplugs, and more. They're packaged in canvas bags that make it so that people can restock the bags themselves and hopefully share them and teach their friends with what they've learned. These are everyday items that people don't think about that they can use for their mental health and maybe don't realize that's what they're already doing. Lawrence said, "The more senses you use when you're in a heightened emotional state, the quicker you can come back from that," she said. The technique is called grounding, or being brought back to the present and calming down from a heightened state of mind. The technique can be achieved with everyday items. For instance, with hand lotion, you're not only smelling the scent, but you're using the tactile sensation of putting it on. Yes, we want to stop the stigma, but when someone's in one of these states, say a grief wave or panic attack, they don't want to draw a lot of attention to themselves," Lawrence said. "Everyone experiences some form of heightened emotion at some point." This year, 250 kits have already been donated to schools and therapy agencies. They are in the Teen Center at the Council Bluffs Public Library. The organization has the supplies for 1,000 kits together and is working to put the rest of them together. 100 kits will be available at this year's Mental Health Awareness event. The Council Bluffs Mental Health Awareness event will be held May 23rd from 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. in Bayless Park. Council Bluffs Cares coordinates the event in conjunction with the Farmers Market, and the first 500 attendees will receive a tote bag and $5 in Farmers Market bucks. The first 100 attendees at the Sail On and Fly High booth will receive a self-calm kit. The event features information on mental health resources, connections to mental health providers, and more. There will be a mental health awareness walk at 7:30 p.m. With its annual golf fundraiser this summer, Sail On and Fly High hopes to do event more kits in the next fiscal year. Eventually, we'd like to do another 1,000 kits in the fall, Lawrence said. For those that want to assist with the Calm kits or aid Sail On and Fly High in some way, the organization has an Amazon wish list that can be made available to those who message through sailonandflyhigh.org, all lowercase. They are also seeking volunteers to assemble kits. Through our tragedy of losing Sailor, the community was so supportive of us that it really inspired us to want to do good things in our community as well, Lawrence said. The next story is entitled Endlessly Interesting, with a subcaption of Author Recounts Story of Rivermen. This is written by Andrew Smith of the Council Bluffs Nonpareil. There's a picture of a man standing at a podium, preparing to speak. He's smiling and sharing his perspective. The subcaption with the picture is, Rivermen author Ben McGrath speaks to a crowd of around 20 on April 16, 2024, about his pursuit of knowledge in the case of free spirit Dick Conant. He came out of the river to tell Rivermen author Ben McGrath his stories of adventure on America's great rivers. His story came to the people of Council Bluffs through the library's Our Community Reads program. McGrath, a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker, was walking with his son along the Hudson River near their home on Labor Day, when his neighbor beckoned him inside to meet Dick Conant, who had just brought his red canoe ashore. McGrath learned of Conant's waterway journey from Canada to Florida and followed him downriver the next day. Conant, the riverman, embarked on 5 major excursions between 1999 and 2014 before disappearing. In November 2019, his canoe was found overturned in the Outer Banks of North Carolina. McGrath was the person who received a call from the park ranger who found the boat. In total, McGrath got to spend around 3 hours with Conant. He taught McGrath about his lifestyle. He ate pickled hot dogs and took shots of Tabasco while on his canoe. He stopped in towns, meeting and recording his interactions with so many faces from these river towns. Conant took obsessive notes and thousands of photos on his trip, often putting together manuscripts and mailing them to estranged family members. I spent a lot of time going through them. To me, it was endlessly interesting, McGrath said. A lot of people I talked to met him and thought, I want to be that guy. I knew I couldn't be like him. I'm a day tripper. He lived anything but a normal life. Conant, who was 63, lived outside since and had been floating America's rivers since 43, but had kept paying rent for storage lockers in Utah and Montana. McGrath met Conant's brother in Montana and found maps, oil paintings, and the manuscripts that Dick had made. When I first met him, it was just going to be a little thing. I never imagined it would be anything more than that, even though he was almost too large to contain in the small article, McGrath said. It wasn't until several months until after he went missing when his family started reaching out to me and sharing more and more information. Whether it was the time when I first laid my hands on the actual maps or when I learned about the storage lockers, to me, that suggested that there was more in the mystery. At that point, McGrath knew he had to compile the stories of Conant's life and his journey from Golden Boy to Riverman. A project like this, as Dick Conant might say, the result of a series of events in a magnificent chain reaction, an unscripted river trip of journalism, McGrath said in the acknowledgement section of his book. Conant's Stone Age mentality has resonated with community members since the book was launched as 2024's adult read for Our Community Reads by the Council Bluffs Public Library with its kickoff event, Waterfest, on March 9th. It's not so much the story of Dick, but how we put it together, said Ray DeWaley, a former English teacher in Omaha. DeWaley and others were on the edge of their seats to ask McGrath about his book and immense knowledge on Conant's life. Books were signed and pressing questions were satisfied at the presentation over Rivermen, the conclusion of this year's program aimed at adults. Our community reads has been going on for 3 years, said Maros Lian, adult programming librarian at the Council Bluffs Public Library. We have a lot of history liking to bring to the Council Bluffs these nationally known authors, and they're like the pop stars of books. Next story is entitled, We Appreciate Our Volunteers, by the Midlands Humane Society. This story is written by Mariah Garcia of the Midlands Humane Society. There's a picture with this of a dog who's crouching on the floor and standing like a good boy. His name is Bubba. This past week, Midland's Humane Society and thousands of nonprofit organizations around the world celebrated National Volunteer Week. The observation takes place the third week of April. It is a time to recognize, thank, and spotlight people who donate their time, talent, voice, and heart to the causes about which they care. MHS is deeply fortunate to have a volunteer team of compassionate animal lovers who work every day towards finding homeless pets their happily ever after. So far in 2024, nearly 2,350 hours of service have been donated by volunteers to MHS. This includes individuals, groups, and community service volunteers. According to Share Iowa, the estimated national value of volunteers is $30 per hour. The breakdown for that at MHS would be $70,500 worth of volunteer hours this January through April. The projected worth through 2024 would be a total of $201,500. Wow, what a number. As a nonprofit organization, it would be nearly impossible to allocate those funds to staffing needs. The service hours volunteered this year are a culmination of some various volunteer roles, including dog walking, cat care, general cleaning, medical assistant, photography and enrichment team. We are excited to continue creating additional opportunities for volunteers in the future as we identify needs within the organization. Whatever skill set you have, you can be sure that we can find a role for you on our volunteer team. To maximize the experience for volunteers and our animals, we ask that volunteers can commit to 6 hours of volunteering per month with a minimum of 6 months. Have access to a computer or phone for onboarding, scheduling, and communications, and be at least 13 years old. Thank you so much to our volunteer team for the hard work and dedication you bring to the animal shelter every day of the week. Saving so many lives would not be possible without your compassion and willingness to do whatever is necessary for the animals. We are so grateful for your support. The MHS Pets of the Week are: Bubba is a 1.5-year-old neutered male pit bull who is sweet as can be. He recently graduated from Clarinda Correctional Facility Dog Training Program, where he continued his basic obedience training and even learned some new tricks. He's a big, lovable guy who will enjoy playing in the yard or going on a nice long walk before curling up with you on the couch. He will need to be adopted to an area without a breed ban. Ginger is a 2-year-old spayed female lab retriever mix that came to us as a stray. She started out timid and shy, but has quickly blossomed into an outgoing girl looking for a human companion that will show her around this big world. We think she would enjoy a playful, confident canine companion that would help her continue to come out of her shell. Sage is a 1.5-year-old spayed female Australian Shepherd pug mix looking for a dedicated owner that is willing to work with her and show her the world really isn't that scary. She can easily become overwhelmed by fast movements and loud noises, so a quieter, laid-back home is what she prefers. She's come a long way and will be the best girl for a patient family who will allow her to come out of her shell. Jackson is a 3-year-old neutered male lab mix who is ready to be the light of your life. He can start off timid in new environments, but once he warms up, he's a fun-loving dude. Jackson has been joining playgroup, and the other dogs have been helping him come out of his shell. MHS is open weekdays from noon to 6 p.m. and Saturdays from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. for those interested in visiting our adoptable pets. You can view our adoptable pets by visiting our website at midlandshumanesociety.org/adopt, all lowercase. Don't forget to get our tickets for our upcoming gala on Friday, May 10th at the Midland America Center. More information can be found from our website or Facebook page. Our next story is entitled Boy Scout Abuse Victims Get Assistance, written by Tom Barton of the Gazette from the Des Moines Bureau. With just hours to spare and under pressure, Iowa House lawmakers passed and Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law legislation temporarily lifting the state's statute on limitations to allow Iowa victims of sexual abuse to receive full compensation from a national bankruptcy settlement with the Boy Scouts of America. Those who were sexually abused while in Boy Scouts should have the ability to receive the greatest amount of compensation available, Reynolds said in a statement. Even after an initial disclosure, it may take many more years before a victim is willing to file legal action in a public court proceeding. We should not stand in the ways of these survivors receiving their justified compensation. I am proud to sign this bill, and I hope it brings some sense of justice and closure. Lawmakers faced a deadline at the end of the day Friday to amend the law. Otherwise, hundreds of Iowa survivors would have received 30% to 45% of the awards they otherwise would be entitled to. The Senate unanimously passed the bill last week. Supporters said the change will help Iowa abuse survivors receive the compensation they deserve and not be financially penalized simply because their abuse occurred in Iowa. I'm grateful lawmakers and the governor stood up for Iowa survivors, who are a part of the largest child sex abuse case in U.S. history, said Senator Janet Peterson, a Democrat from Des Moines. Today's victory is a great example of how the legislature can help people when we work together for justice, and when the media shines a light on an important issue, Peterson said. Hundreds of Iowans will have a chance at receiving their full settlement thanks to a group of survivors who came forward, shared their painful stories, and asked for our help. Republican Iowa House Speaker Pat Grassley told reporters last week he was hesitant to advance the bill, calling it a significant policy change that merited further scrutiny. Grassley told reporters last week he was concerned about broadening Iowa's civil statute of limitations, even though the bill was narrowly written to only apply to the Boy Scout bankruptcy settlement. Representative Steve Holt, a Republican from Denison, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, echoed those concerns during a House Budget Committee meeting on the bill Friday. Republican Gary Moore, a Republican from Bettendorf, chair of the House Appropriations Committee, said, "Everyone feels the pain for those molested as children by Scout leaders. That was an awful travesty," Moore told reporters. "But there's a lot of other people that have suffered as well and that have missed their statute of limitations. What happens to them?" And that's been the concern of a few members of our caucus. House Republicans amended the bill to state, but for the unusual and exceptionally rare circumstances in this case, after the fact, enlargement of statute of limitations would not be considered, and it's not the legislator's intention to create a precedent for further legislative action. Such exceptions tend to erode the rule of law and respect for the doctrine of equal protection, the amendment states. However, a discrete group of Iowa sexual abuse victims face a grotesque miscarriage of justice without legislative action, the amended bill states. It emphasizes the action taken by the General Assembly is not to be considered or offered in the future as creating a precedent for further legislative action. The House passed the bill 90-1, sending it back to the Senate, which concurred with the amendment. The governor quickly signed the bill.
You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 23rd, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, in Des Moines. I'm Elliot Nelson from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or concerns about this, or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Here is the obituary. One such individual, Grace I. Barker. She lived from September 3rd, 1933 to April 9th, 2024. Preceded in death by husband, Ralph, parents Lloyd and Olga Solem, brothers and sisters John Solem, Don Solem, Carl and Marie Jeanette Runge, Lavon Davidson, Gordon Solem, and Rosemary Solem, nephews Mark Solem and Tim Solem, niece Kathy Jacobson, survived by son Clarence Vicky Barker, grandson Joshua Barker, other relatives Pat Thale, Avis Erickson, Larry Solem, Johnny Solem, Vicky Jones, Bonnie Schultz, Carla Fernschild, Bertha Wilson, Debbie Mulville, Lori Cullen, Lynn Smith, Pamela Davis, Mike Barber, Donnie Jones, Grace Riggs, Marilyn Smith. Visitation is Sunday, April 28th, beginning at 2 p.m., with funeral service at 3 p.m. at the funeral home. Our next story is entitled The Chance to Heal, with a subcaption of Injured Israelis Find Normalcy in Amputee Team. This is written by Pamela Sampson of the Associated Press. There's a picture with an individual with an amputated leg playing soccer, entitled, or with the caption, Ben Binyamin controls the ball during a practice session with the Israel amputee football team on April 11th in Ramat Gan, Israel. Binyamin was celebrating his 29th birthday at the Tribe of Nova Music Festival on October 7th when Hamas militants stormed into southern Israel and opened fire. He was seriously wounded, his right leg blown off. War in Middle East, Ramat Gan, Israel. Here's the story. When Ben Miniam was left for dead, his right leg blown off during the Hamas attack on the Tribe of Nova Music Festival, the Israeli professional soccer player thought he would never again play the game he loved. When I woke up, the 29-year-old said, I felt like I was going to spend the rest of my life in a wheelchair. Then Binyamin learned about a chance to be normal again, Israel's national amputee soccer team. The team, which includes two Israeli soldiers who lost limbs fighting in the war with Hamas, has offered all three a chance to heal from life-altering wounds suffered during the October 7th attacks and in Israel's ensuing war in Gaza. It heads to France in June for the European Amputee Football Championships. Some 16 teams, mostly from Europe, will compete. It's the best thing in my life, said First Sergeant Omer Glickstahl of the team's twice-weekly practices at a stadium in the Tel Aviv suburb of Ramat Gan. The 20-year-old soldier from Haifa regularly played soccer until his life was turned upside down when a rocket-propelled grenade shattered his left foot during a battle in Gaza in November. It's a very different game than I used to play, but in the end, it's the same, he said. Dozens of Israelis lost limbs during the Hamas attacks that killed some 1,200 people in southern Israel in the war that followed. Sheba Medical Center in Ramat Gan, home to a major rehabilitation center, says it alone has treated about 60 amputees. Israel's defense ministry says 1,573 soldiers have been wounded since Israel began its ground offensive in late October, in which troops have engaged in close combat with Hamas militants. The military did not have a specific statistics on amputees, but said some 320 soldiers were critically wounded. The Israeli athletes and others who lost limbs have benefited from a world-class medical system that has decades of experience treating young people injured in wars and conflict. In Gaza, unknown members of Palestinians have also lost limbs in a war that has claimed nearly 34,000 lives, according to Gaza health officials. Gaza's health system has been overwhelmed by the war, and doctors and patients say they often need to choose between amputation or death. Before the war, Gaza also had a fledgling team of amputee soccer players wounded in previous conflicts with Israel. Shaked Bitten, an Israeli army division commander, lost his right leg when he was shot by a Hamas sniper with a .50 caliber round, the type that can blast through concrete near the Jabalia refugee camp in late October. I heard two shots, I fell down, I looked back, the 21-year-old soldier said, and I saw my leg. Bitten thought his life was over. He had never even met an amputee before, until he was visited in the hospital by others who had lost limbs and successfully resumed their lives. Among them was Zach Schritcher, founder of Israel's national amputee soccer team. Severely injured when a bus ran over his foot at age 8, he knew what these men were going through and he offered them hope. There's nothing greater than to go out and compete at the international level when you have the Israeli flag on your chest. Most of us, if not all, could not have even imagined something like this, says Schritcher, 36, an attorney and the team's captain. Since its founding 5 years ago, the Israeli team has met with growing success, placing third in the Nations League in Belgium in October. That qualified it to compete in the European Championship in June. Amputee soccer teams have six fielder players who are missing lower limbs. They play in crutches and without prosthetics. Each team has a goalkeeper with a missing upper extremity. The pitch is smaller than standard. At team practices, the Israeli players are undeterred by the absence of an arm or a leg, whether from an accident, a war injury, or a birth defect. We all have something in common. We've been through a lot of hard and difficult times. It unites us, said Aviran Ohana, a cybersecurity expert whose right leg is shorter than his left due to a birth defect and who has played with the team for 2 years. On a recent April evening, the team started its warm-up with sprints around the pitch, the men speeding forward propelled by one leg, steadied by their crutches. A game against able-bodied teenagers followed. Binyamin, dripping with sweat, kicked the ball with his left leg as the coach shouted from the sideline, "Forward, forward." Every goal was celebrated. Sir Ludwig Gutmann, a Jewish neurologist who fled Nazi Germany in 1939 and settled into Britain, is credited with pioneering competitive sports as a form of rehabilitation. Gutmann, who organized the first competition for wheelchair athletes on the opening day of the 1948 London Olympic Games, is considered the father of the Paralympic Games, and his legacy has enhanced the lives of thousands of handicapped athletes. In Israel today, the amputee soccer team offers the player The player is the excitement of competition and the healing powers of sport, said McCall Nichama, the team's physical therapist. They need it for their soul, she said. It gives them joy, pride, that extra thing you can't give in a hospital. We have another sports story entitled Second Half Double Lewis Central Gets Past Glenwood. It's written by Peter Burnett of the Council Bluffs Nonpareil. There's a picture with girls on the soccer team playing with one player passing it to another as another one tries to tackle the other. This photo has the caption, Lewis Central's Maya Humlesek left number 2022 and Izzy McNeil compete with Glenwood's Lydia Fuas during a Hawkeye 10 girls soccer match on Friday. The always entertaining rivalry between Lewis Central and Glenwood added another chapter with some excellent goals. A fan ejection in a second half double from the 2A number 7 Titans for the win. Lewis Central lost 1-0 to the Rams in last year's 2A 7 substate semifinal. It was a game that you didn't really have to motivate the girls, Titans head coach Jesse Smith said. So it was more about how he wanted to play. And credits to Glenwood last year. You know, they had a game play they executed and we weren't able to figure it out. Today, we were able to figure out what they were trying to do and play our style, and we were successful with it. It means a good chunk to us since we lost last year, and coming back and beating them makes it feel really good, said Titans junior winger Maya Humlesek, who scored the third goal in the 3-1 win. Very, very satisfied, added senior midfielder Izzy McNeil, who scored the go-ahead goal in the 54th minute and assisted Humlesek. This is like our one game that we really wanted to win this year. So glad we came on top. In a first half that favored the visiting Titans, Lewis Central got on the board via an 8th-minute goal by Ireland White. The freshman got the ball with plenty of space just outside the penalty box and unleashed a shot that glanced off the fingertips of Glenwood goalie Audrey Neiman and into the top right corner of the net for a team-leading 13th goal. A lot of credit goes to a lot of the seniors, with Kenzie Steffens stepping to the ball first right, Smith said. Then we had a lot of midfielders work with Ireland and Izzy, who were working their tails off to help win those second balls, and then finding feet afterwards, and it was really good. It was really pleasing to see the play from the midfields into the wide spaces. 4 minutes later, Brielle Allman dragged a shot across the face of goal as the Rams remained 1-0 down. Slowly but surely, as they held off pressure from Lewis Central, Glenwood had their top goal scorer step up in the 27th minute. Off the feed from Faith Weber, junior Jalen Floyd deftly lifted a chip that seemed to be heading over the crossbar, but dipped under at the last second, and even the match at 1-1. There are still some shape things we need to work on, Smith said, and that's how they were able to pop us with their goal. They were able to get behind our space, creating miscommunication in our back line. The Rams used a stopper-sweeper tactic. One defender comes forward to stop the ball, another steps back to sweep up anything that could get through, which caused the Titans problems and led to Floyd's goal. I think what we were doing really well is they were stepping up to the ball really well, and they're a good physical backline, Smith said in response to the Rams' defense. 10 minutes later, after a Lewis Central foul at midfield, the Titans fans on the opposite side of the field from the Glenwood press box and team benches could be heard saying, call it, speak to the match, fair. The assistant referee on the touchline called over to the center referee, who then spoke to Smith. Smith went over to the Titans section, and a Lewis Central fan was ejected from the match. From my perspective, all I know is that there was something said to the ref. They didn't really tell me exactly what it was, he said. But they said, since there was no AD here at that time, so I needed to go over and ask for that person to leave. And they left cordially. The second half began mostly in the Glenwood defensive half, though the Rams did get some forward momentum, but rarely got into the final third through the first 10 minutes. McKenna Kohler even had the chance to give the hosts the lead, but was denied by Lewis Central goalie Avery Harding's full extension. Taking advantage of the opportunity, the Titans quickly struck for a second half double. First, McNeil turned and fired a shot from inside the box in the 54th minute, and Humlesek followed in the 60th from the left wing as Lewis Central lunged in front, 6-1. I think we do a really good job of keeping possession, knowing when we can draw back, knowing when we don't have to push everything so direct, McNeil said, and Maya's really fast on the wing. I think it's really important that we have good passing in the middle so that it has good execution on the outside, Humlesek added. So then I think it follows through in the end when we all have good finishes. The team's goal was to press high and push the pace, which both said benefited the Titans in their goals. The Titans remained on the front foot and held on for a fifth win in 7 matches. Right now, we're in a space where they've learned to play with some urgency and come with purpose, Smith said. Now, today was really nice to see that it was urgency. It was purpose, but it was our style as well. So we're trying to find feet, trying to build up, trying to do those sort of things. And so it's a good building block. The Rams, meanwhile, lost their 4th straight and 5th in 6 matches. Lewis Central next plays at Creston 5 p.m. Tuesday, while Glenwood goes to Kemper High Catholic at 5:30 p.m. Tuesday. This next article is entitled, Jaden and Jordan DeWaley Commit to Iowa Western, written by Peter Burntnett of the Council Bluffs Nonpareil. This one has a picture with a Jordan DeWaley shooting a free throw during a game. Next Friday night, Thomas Jefferson's DeWaley brothers, Jaden and Jordan, announced their commitments to Iowa Western. Jaden averaged 9.3 points, 6.3 rebounds, 1.8 steals, 1.5 assists, and 0.5 blocks per game, while shooting 39.8% from the field and 73.5% on free throws. Jordan, meanwhile, averaged 16.9 points, 7.9 rebounds, 2.1 assists, 0.9 steals, and 0.5 blocks per game, while shooting 51.1% on field goals. Both helped lead the Yellow Jackets to the winningest season in their history, 19-5, and had a senior year that won't be forgotten at the corner of West Broadway and South 25th Street. Now, the DeWaleys will take their talents just down West Broadway and East Canesville Boulevard to Iowa Western. The Reavers men's basketball finished 16-15 this season, losing to Ellsworth Community College in the Region 11 quarterfinals. The Nonpareil will have more on this story later. Our next story is entitled Lynx Second Half Surge Downs Falcons, written by Austin Heinen of the Council Bluffs Nonpareil. This picture has a picture of two soccer players standing on the field, excited. It's entitled Owls Irving Cruz and Kai Bergeson celebrate after Bergeson's goal late in the second half. Abraham Lincoln scored 3 unanswered goals to pull away from the Class 1A number 8 St. Albert in this inner-city contest at Gail Wickersham's Stadium 5-2. The Lynx felt their first half performance was a bit sluggish, but then picked it up in the second half. The fact it was 1-1 at half, we just weren't doing what we'd been working on, and our midfield was flat, Lynx coach Jamison Parkhill said. We made the adjustment at halftime, and we really took to it and shut down their midfield. We were able to start finding feet and go after their back line like we wanted to. It was really good to see some of our guys respond in the second half. The game started quiet through the majority of the first half. Though both teams had their chances, the Falcons and Lynx couldn't break the scoreless tie for most of the first half. Finally, in the 35th minute, Kane Hughes got tripped up in the attacking box and put in a penalty shot to put the Falcons ahead. The lead would last for only about a minute as Irving Cruz scored the equalizer in the 36th minute to tie the game at halftime, 1-1. We felt like we shouldn't have given up that penalty kick, but that's just unlucky, Cruz said. I saw Julian play the ball to me, and I thought about dribbling down the line, but there was a couple people on me, so I cut back and shot it, and it went in. The offense heated up in the second half as the Lynx took their first lead with a 48th-minute goal from Javier Rivera. However, that lead did not last even a minute, as Morgan Young brought St. Albert even with the Lynx at 2-2 about 30 seconds later. The team stayed deadlocked at 2-2 for about 8 minutes. Julian Jimenez then broke the tie in the 57th minute, and this time put the Lynx up for good. I was kind of just sitting there for a while, and Kyle Sanchez just slid it to me, Jimenez said. He had the ball at the top of the 18 and slotted it back to me, and I took my chance. I tried looking for some open space first, dribbled through, and put it away in the right corner. Jonathan Amador would add the insurance marker in the 68th minute, and Kai Bergeson netted the dagger in the 73rd minute off a rebound from the goalkeeper. The Lynx will look for their third straight win as they host Lamar's on Monday at 5:30 p.m. St. Albert will look to bounce back on Monday when they host Tri-Center at the CB Rec Fields at 6 p.m. St. Albert has a record of 5-4. Abraham Lincoln has a record of 3-5. Now moving on to some lifestyle. This story is entitled Enviable Greens, with a subcaption of Usher in Spring Salad Season with These Easy Recipes, written by Gretchen McKay of the Pittsburgh Post and Gazette. There's a picture of a cookbook entitled Cooking for Two, If you're a cook, spring is when you can look forward to a bounty of fresh herbs, tender lettuces, and green vegetables, not just in the grocery store, but at local farmers markets. Sure, you can find fresh vegetables year-round at even the smallest markets. They're just extra awesome when you know something is only available for a few weeks, or has been grown nearby by a local farmer. After our long winter nap, we can feel a little rusty coming up with fresh ideas for really great salads, or seasonal sides. The three easy recipes from three new cookbooks that follow are a great way to get started. One from Christopher Kimball's very engaging latest tome, Milk Street 365, the all-purpose cookbook for every day of the year, turns a traditional chicken salad on its head by tossing the meat in a creamy and super green tahini herb dressing instead of mayonnaise. It includes sliced green apple and celery for extra crunch. A recipe from America's Test Kitchen's new The Complete Cooking for Two cookbook, 10th Anniversary Edition, joins sweet and delicately briny scallops with sugar snap peas and the zesty bite of fresh radish. And for you asparagus lovers, we capture the flavors of the French Riviera with a recipe from French food writer Rosa Jackson's just-released cookbook, Niquoise, market-inspired cooking from France's sunniest city. It dishes up asparagus in a zesty but incredibly simple yogurt dressing with a lovely grated egg garnish. All can be prepared in less than a half an hour and are gorgeous on the table. That leaves plenty of time and energy for where most of us really want to be spending time when April showers give way to spring sunshine outside. We've also included Milk Street's foolproof vinaigrette recipe for those fuss-free days when a simple bowl of salad greens suffices as a side or starter. The recipe for seared scallop salad with snap peas and radishes serves too. This elegant dinner salad pairs sweet and tender scallops with fresh spring vegetables. They're tossed in a simple vinaigrette with mesclun, a mix of young salad greens that include chervil, arugula, leafy lettuces, and endive. The ingredients are 12 ounces of large sea scallops, tendons removed, 1 tablespoon red wine vinegar, a half a teaspoon Dijon mustard, 3 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil divided, 6 ounces sugar snap peas, strings removed, halved crosswise, 4 cups of mesclun, 4 radishes trimmed and sliced thin, 1 shallot sliced thin, a half a teaspoon of table salt, half a teaspoon of pepper. Directions. Place scallops on a large plate lined with clean dish towel. Place a second clean dish towel on top of scallops and press gently on towel to blot liquid. Let scallops sit at room temperature for 10 minutes while towels absorb moisture. Meanwhile, combine vinegar and mustard in large bowl. Whisking constantly, drizzle 2 tablespoons oil into vinegar mixture in slow, steady stream. Add snap peas, mesclun, radishes, and shallot and toss gently to coat. Divide salad among individual plates or transfer to a serving platter. Sprinkle scallops with salt and pepper. Heat remaining 1 tablespoon oil in 12-inch nonstick skillet over high heat until just smoking. Add scallops in a single layer, flat side down, and cook without moving until well browned, 1.5 to 2 minutes. Flip scallops and continue to cook until sides of scallops are firm and centers are opaque, 30 to 90 seconds. Arrange scallops over salad and serve. From The Complete Cooking for Two cookbook, 10th Anniversary by America's Test Kitchen. Our next story is another lifestyle story entitled The Ouchless Jab. Needle pain is a big problem for kids. One doctor has a plan to help ease it. This is written by April Dembowski of the KFF Health News. Almost all new parents go through it. The distress of hearing their child scream at the doctor's office. They endure the emotional torture of having to hold their child down as the clinician vaccinates them. The first shots he got, I probably cried more than he did, Remy Anthus said of her 6-month-year-old Dorian. The look in her eyes is hard to take, said Jill Lovett, recalling how her infant daughter Jenna reacted to some recent vaccines. Like, what are you letting them do to me? Why? Some children remember the needle pain and quickly start to internalize the fear. That's the fear Julia Kramer witnessed when her 3-year-old daughter, Maya, had to get blood drawn for an allergy test at age 2. After that, she had a fear of blue gloves. Kramer said, I went to the grocery store and she saw someone wearing blue gloves, stocking the vegetables, and she started freaking out and crying. A spiraling problem. Pain management research suggests that needle pokes may be children's biggest source of pain in the healthcare system. The problem isn't confined to childhood vaccinations either. Studies looking at sources of pediatric pain have included children who are being treated for serious illness, have undergone heart surgeries or bone marrow transplants, or have landed in the emergency room. This is so bad that many children and many parents decide not to continue the treatment, said Stefan Friedrichsdorf, a specialist at the University of California, San Francisco's STAD Center for Pediatric Pain, speaking at the End Well conference in Los Angeles in November. The distress of needle pain can follow children as they grow and interfere with important preventive care. It is estimated that a quarter of all adults have a fear of needles that began in childhood. 16% of adults refuse flu vaccinations because of a fear of needles. Friedrichsdorf said it doesn't have to be this bad. This is not rocket science, he said. He outlined simple steps that clinicians and parents can follow. Apply an over-the-counter lidocaine, a numbing cream, 30 minutes before a shot. Breastfeed babies or give them a pacifier dipped in sugar water to comfort them while they're getting a shot. Use distractions like teddy bears, pinwheels, or bubbles to divert attention away from the needle. Don't pin kids down on an exam table. Parents should hold children in their laps instead, changing parents' minds. At Children's Minnesota, Friedrichsdorf practiced the children's comfort promise. Now he and other healthcare providers are rolling out these new protocols for children at UCSF Benioff Children's Hospitals in San Francisco and Oakland. He's calling it the Ouchless Jab Challenge. If a child at UCSF needs to get poked for a blood draw, a vaccine, or an IV treatment, Friedrichsdorf promises the clinicians will do everything possible to follow these pain management steps. Every child, every time, he said. Friedrichsdorf hopes that making routine healthcare less painful can help sway parents who may be hesitant to get their children vaccinated because of how hard it is to see them in pain. In turn, children who grow into adults without a fear of needles might be more likely to get preventive care, including their yearly flu shot. In general, the onus will likely be on parents to take a leading role in demanding these measures at medical centers, Friedrichsdorf said, because the tolerance and acceptance of children's pain is so entrenched among clinicians. Diane Meyer, a palliative care specialist at Mount Sinai, agrees. She said this tolerance is a major problem, stemming from how doctors are usually trained. We are taught to see pain as an unfortunate but inevitable side effect of good treatment, Meyer said. We learn to repress that feeling of distress at the pain we are feeling, because otherwise we can't do our jobs. Not just for kids. During her medical training, Meyer had to hold children down for procedures, which she described as torture for them and for her. It drove her out of pediatrics. She went into geriatrics instead, and later helped lead the modern movement to promote palliative care in medicine, which became an accredited specialty in the United States only in 2006. Meyer said she thinks the campaign to reduce needle pain and anxiety should be applied to everyone, not just to children. People with dementia have no idea why human beings are approaching them to stick needles in them, she said, and the experience can be painful and distressing. Friedrichsdorf's techniques will likely work with dementia patients too, she said. Numbing cream, distraction, something sweet in the mouth, and perhaps music from the patient's youth that they can remember and can sing along to. It's worthy of study, and it's worthy of serious attention, Meyer said. Our next and final story comes from the Medicine Cabinet, is entitled Ways to Reduce Ringing in Ears, written by Dr. Howard Lewine of Harvard Health Publishing. Question. I have a persistent ringing in my ears, mostly in my right ear. My hearing test showed mild hearing loss. What can I try before spending money on hearing aids? Answer. You are one of the estimated 15% of American adults who suffer from tinnitus. For many, it's a high-pitched ringing, while for others, it sounds like whistling, whooshing, buzzing, chirping, hissing, humming, roaring, or even shrieking. It may be constant or intermittent, steady, or pulsating. While there presently is no cure for tinnitus, there are many ways people can manage it so the symptoms do not disrupt their daily lives. Tinnitus commonly begins in older age and has a close association with hearing loss. It also may occur from long-term exposure to loud noises, a medication side effect, or something as simple as earwax buildup. It's unclear what happens in the brain to create the noises. One explanation is that the auditory nerve begins to fray, diminishing normal sounds. Neurons in the brain's auditory processing center compensate for this loss by becoming more sensitive. the sensitivity knobs get turned up so high that neurons begin to respond to the activity of other nearby neurons, which create the perceptions of a sound that does not exist. Here are some techniques that may help reduce the symptoms. Learn your triggers. Write down the circumstances when tinnitus symptoms bother you. It helps you to anticipate, prevent, and change situations that may make tinnitus worse. Try a masking device. This device looks like a hearing aid and produces sounds, such as nature sounds, that make tinnitus seem quieter. The sound distracts the brain, and tinnitus symptoms become easier to tolerate. But you don't always need a fancy ear device to mask tinnitus sounds. Listening to music or white noise helps distract your brain, so you pay less attention to the tinnitus. Exercise. Regular physical activity can reduce the frequency and intensity of tinnitus and the distress it causes. Try mindfulness. A program called Mindfulness-Based Tinnitus Stress Reduction builds skills in deep breathing, yoga, relaxation, and meditation to help a person deal with tinnitus. Mindfulness programs have been shown to reduce depression and anxiety while improving social functioning and overall mental health in people with tinnitus. Consider other therapies. Cognitive behavioral therapy can help you identify negative thoughts about tinnitus and reframe the way you think about and react to tinnitus. Tinnitus refraining therapy uses counseling and sound masking to help the brain relearn hearing patterns so tinnitus is less noticeable. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 23rd, 2024. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Elliot Nelson from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with me and with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Have a good day.